And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, what to do about those ever-rising FOIA request backlogs? Plus, why selling software to the government is like visiting a confessional booth. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, federal telework in the long term could let agencies get rid of office space they no longer need. That's according to a recent study by the National Capital Planning Commission and the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. But it may also shake up the local economy, since the federal government is the largest single owner of real estate in the region. For a closer look at the findings, Federal News Network's Jory Heckman spoke with the commission's senior urban planner, Angela DuPont.
Over a year ago, the National Capital Planning Commission, in partnership with the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, we decided to conduct the study to better understand the cumulative impacts of federal telework and hybrid workplaces on the National Capital Region. Our region's economy and the federal government presence are strongly linked. We have a federal government, which is the single largest property owner and employer in the region, with over 400,000 federal workers in the National Capital Region, making up 11% of the total region employment. But with the pandemic, we saw this increased use of federal telework, which greatly impacted the region in many ways, which still play out today. So we decided at that time to conduct this study to play out a few different scenarios to understand that long-term impact of how those scenarios could also impact the federal real estate, the federal workforce, where federal workers live, and also federal commuting, to help inform our policy direction and our comprehensive plan.
To dive into, I guess, really what the study takes a look at here, you were mentioning about telework on its impact on federal kind of real estate presence in the area. A number of administrations have obviously been looking at freezing the federal footprint and then eventually reducing the federal footprint. So just given what we've seen over the past couple of years with a greater presence of telework amongst the federal workforce, how might telework reduce or accelerate those efforts to reduce the federal footprint?
Sure. So we definitely looked at different scenarios, from minimum telework to moderate to maximum. Minimum, probably looking back at the pre-pandemic stage of how the federal workers were using telework. And then considering these different trends, like reduce the federal footprint. I think before the pandemic, we already acknowledged that there were a lot of federal buildings that were underutilized. Federal telework just helps accelerate the opportunities to either use our space better when federal agencies may be consolidating in the future. So I think that's how we were considering it, from minimum, moderate to maximum. As you get to more telework, there is probably a greater ability to reduce a lot of this federal office space, because the demand for a federal office may not be as great when you have more federal workers teleworking. So there's the ability to then reduce that space need.
All right. Now, I know that you guys are looking at a range of different telework options and how long that, you know, continues to be the case going forward. But what ultimately happens to the region when the federal government, the biggest owner of office space in the region, no longer needs quite as much office space? What do you see there?
I could probably weigh in on that. I think you see a set of challenges that the region is facing. And I think this is why it was so important for us to partner with COG, because they're looking at it as a region, and all the regional local jurisdictions, they're trying to figure out, what do we do with, you know, federal leases no longer being there? What do we do with not that many federal workers taking the metro anymore? There's like all these set of challenges that they're trying to deal with. So it was critical for us to all have this conversation together in order for us to be a stronger region. I think we need to move forward understanding, well, where should we be heading? We have a baseline of understanding of where we're kind of going and what those challenges may be. Now, how can we all work together to address them moving forward?
Got it. And one thing I took away from the executive summary of what you guys put together is that the impact that we might see going forward, this might be disproportionate in its impact, that, you know, DC might be feeling this more than other counties in the area. Can you briefly explain just how the disproportionality potentially of, as these leases come up, what might ultimately happen.
There are certain types of federal uses and jobs that are more conducive in person. And I think that's, you know, through the interviews with federal agencies, through this research, we've realized Virginia has a high defense presence. Maryland has a high, like there's research lab components. And in DC, there is a lot of administrative headquarters types of jobs that are more conducive to telework. And so when we have this larger conversation, yes, I agree. I think where we see DC is probably getting more impacted. They have a lot of the federal workforce that actually work in DC. However, they live outside of DC. And so there's this challenge ahead for DC, given that there's this, I think, the types of jobs that currently exist there. There is a large portion of the federal leases that are expiring in DC. They have a large square footage and the demand is probably less. So if the trend is still going from lease to federally owned, not saying that all federal leases will disappear, it's still a tool in the toolbox for the federal government. I think that's one area where they will see probably the largest impact with federal office space will be in DC. I would also say that from conversations that we've had, even with Department of Defense and the Washington Headquarters Services, they do have lease space that there's still the ability to reduce, but it just probably won't be as great as what we're seeing in DC and other federal agencies.
Obviously, the lease side of the federal office space, that's the easiest to give up. But given the fluctuations, I guess you could say, with what we've been seeing, like we've been seeing telework being, you know, a going concern for the federal workforce for a while, but we're seeing, you know, more of a return to office. Like, it just seems like agencies can kind of flex up and down their leased office space to kind of meet that demand versus like owned office space. Just any thoughts there on just kind of how that, to your point, how that's a tool in the toolbox for still figuring out what is, I guess, still kind of an uncertain future for the future of the federal office space.
Yeah, you know, the thing that we've been hearing, it takes money to invest in good space for us to then, you know, I think have these consolidation efforts. It doesn't happen so quickly, as you know, Jory. And so why we have focus on federal lease space is because leases are expiring. So federal agencies have to then decide. They're like kind of forced to start making, reevaluating their space needs more immediate than if you were located in owned space. And I think that's why we've kind of been looking at that piece of the conversation. But again, a lot of the impacts that we're going to be seeing in the federal real estate will not happen immediately in the near term, just because it takes time to get the money to reinvest in these types of spaces, even before we see these larger consolidation efforts. And I think even with reduced footprint, I think agencies were probably making decisions like a decade ago, right? And things are finally playing out now. So the study's kind of looking things in the long term of how it could play out. In the near term, I think what we're seeing now, there's still a lot of unknown. We're going to continue to feel that for a bit. But in the long term, we will eventually probably see a changing of the federal footprint.
Angela DuPont, Senior Urban Planner at the National Capital Planning Commission, speaking with Federal News Network's Jory Heckman. Check out Jory's story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, why selling software to the government is like visiting a confessional booth. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Final rules have kicked in for companies selling software to the government. They must now attest to the fact that they used secure development practices. Their reference has to be the Secure Software Development Framework from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Here with what really has to happen, the Chief Technology Officer of Legit Security, Joe Nicastro. Mr. Nicastro, good to have you with us.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on, Tom.
And you are advising agencies on how to handle this rule. So let's begin with the contractor side, though. What do they have to do now, and for what types of products must they do it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So largely with the SolarWinds attacks that happened, there was an executive order that came out essentially saying that, you know, NIST was going to create a new guideline or framework around software supply chain security, which ended up becoming the NIST SSDF. And then very shortly after that, you know, CISA decided to utilize that SSDF as part of an attestation for them for companies that are selling software to the overall government. This was in commenting period, but as of last week, it was finalized, which essentially means that within the next 3 months, all critical software that's being sold to the government needs to have this attestation done. All non-critical software that's being sold to the government needs to have this attestation done within 6 months. And essentially what this attestation is a form that is being signed off by either the CEO or some other designated C-level person within that organization, or a third-party authorized regulator that's going to come in and essentially say, hey, these particular controls that are in place properly, and we're attesting to CISA that this company is following by appropriate standards and practices for their software development.
If you're a Microsoft or a SaaS or a Salesforce or Oracle or any of these giants that pretty much dominate the software industry, don't they already use secure development practices? I mean, not that there's never a vulnerability, but do they have anything to fear if they make this attestation?
I think most organizations have a lot of the controls that are being asked for by SSDF in place, right? Things like having the appropriate application security tooling, whether that's static analysis, dynamic analysis, you know, software composition analysis, et cetera. I think where, you know, most of the organizations are going to struggle putting in some of these additional controls is largely going to be around the overall supply chain itself. There's a lot of tools on the market right now that primarily focus on the risk within an application. Not a lot of tools out there that are focusing on the risk in the actual software factory that's creating this code. And I think that's the reason why we've seen a lot of software supply chain attacks increase over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, sometimes upwards of 600-700% year over year, right? So I definitely think that larger companies have the capability of meeting these controls. I think they obviously have a little bit more work to do, but definitely something that I think that they'll be able to get done. I think the bigger struggle for especially large companies is going to be attesting to this in an automated way. I think one of the things that's lacking in this new CISA attestation is the ability for organizations like Microsoft or these large organizations to attest in an automated fashion. Right now, it's largely PDF driven or filling out a form on a website. And when we're doing things at the speed of development, any manual processes like this are going to slow that down. And I think that's going to be the biggest hurdle for organizations as we move forward.
And just backing up the food chain for a moment, the reality of most commercial software is that there's a little bit of coding by the vendor, and mostly they've assembled open source components that might be common to 10,000 other programs. So is that going to be an impediment to being able to safely make an attestation?
So I think, again, a lot of the organizations that we're talking about have some form of testing with regards to software composition analysis to make sure that the open source packages that they're bringing in are healthy and don't have a lot of risk to them. But yeah, definitely going to be a concern as we move forward is making sure that, again, the packages that we're using aren't introducing additional risk into that organization. I think the bigger picture, though, is looking at how that open source and those packages are being utilized in the application as a whole within the organization to really start looking at risk holistically, as opposed to just determining whether or not there's a vulnerability in a package that maybe not an active code, maybe not touched by the overall, you know, code that's being used, you know, maybe not even have a reachable vulnerability, et cetera.
We're speaking with Joe Nicastro. He's field CTO of Legit Security. And a final question on the vendor side. What are the consequences if they make this attestation and then some vulnerability is exposed? Because I don't think their software has been published yet where somebody can't hack something. So what happens then?
I think this is something that we're all waiting to kind of see. I think there's definitely been some precedent set with the Uber CISO, you know, going to jail and the SEC suing the CISO for SolarWinds. So I definitely think that there's some precedence there for there to be an ownership or an onus on the overall leader of the security programs at these companies. I don't think that there's a very real threat out there of what's going to happen should you attest to something like that and have, you know, a breach or something that's shown that maybe you attested to something improperly. But again, I do think that we're starting to see a shift in the way that, you know, we're looking at these from a legal standpoint, where there is going to be some level of personal responsibility being held by either the CTO, the CISO, or somebody else who's signing these overall attestations, saying that, you know, if there is a breach, there's going to be consequences.
Well, hopefully they'll get minimum security. And moving over to the government side, what do contracting officers, is that the point of enforcement of this? What are you telling them they need to do now to make sure they get the right documentation in of the attestation.
If we're talking about from the government standpoint, like CISA and what, you know, I think they need to adjust in order to make this a little bit easier for organizations, largely, like we talked about, some form of way of automating these overall attestations into the government. Again, if we're talking about organizations that have one or two applications, you know, filling out a PDF is not a large lift. But when you're talking about organizations that have upwards of 100, 1,000, even 10,000 applications that they're selling to the overall government, running through 10,000 manual PDF to sign each attestation becomes a very large lift. And at that point, you're slowing down the development process to the point where, again, it's something that most organizations are really going to think about whether or not this is something that's important for them to do. I think if CISA could come out with some form of way of automating these forms, whether allowing for, you know, an API ingestion or something like that, it definitely allows organizations to start to pin these attestations directly into their overall development processes so that they can start to attest to these things as development is happening with all of the controls that they already have in place.
Both sides then really need the grease, if you will, of an automated process that is nevertheless tied to something that legitimately happened.
100%, right? I mean, the whole goal of all of the security that we put in place with development is that the security moves at the pace of development, right? Our goal is never to slow down that development process largely because, again, this is typically how businesses are making money. It's how they're creating feature sets. It's how they're keeping relevant in their overall spaces. So if we slow that down, there's other risk or ramifications that affect the overall business, right? So our goal as security should always be to implement these practices or controls in a way that's really invisible or transparent to the overall development process. And I think the same thing with this is attestation, right? Being able to grease, in your words, both sides so that we can attest to these things in a way that's reasonable, as well as that's, you know, giving the information that the government needs to show that these controls are in place, is going to be very important to this entire program being successful.
And what about resellers that really do move a lot of the software? Are they just third-party pass-throughs and the attestation is still belongs to the vendor?
Yeah. So at that point, I mean, I think what we're going to see with a lot of the resellers is they're going to be, you know, spinning up services that will essentially do the attestation for them, right? No different than what we see with like third parties that are doing a lot of the FedRAMP attestations for that side, where it's now become a service. I think we'll see the same thing with the CISA attestations, where organizations will start to come out and basically sell those services to organizations and say, hey, we'll validate your controls. We'll, you know, make sure that everything you're doing is according to the overall CISA attestation requirements. And then we'll sign off on it for you.
That could be a new value-added profitable service.
Yes, 100%. I definitely, like I said, I definitely see that something is going to pick up with a bunch of the resellers and different types of compliance agencies out there. Again, we see it with things like FedRAMP already. We see it with SOC 2 and all of the other compliances out there. A lot of these compliances are really hard to meet, right? And so if you can have a third party come in and give you an understanding of where you have those gaps and fixing those gaps, it makes it substantially easier.
Yeah, I can see the new We Have Attested socks being given out at all the trade shows.
I like it. That's one of my favorite things about the trade shows is all the fun socks that are out there. I'm definitely down for some CISA attestation socks.
Joe Nicastro is Field Chief Technology Officer of Legit Security. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Tom. Appreciate you having me on.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, we'll have another take on that same rule from a contractor attorney. But first, what to do about those ever-rising FOIA request backlogs? This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA requests, keep rising every year. Some agencies have trouble responding to them on time, so backlogs grow. The Government Accountability Office finds the Justice Department bureau that oversees FOIA activity could improve its guidance on how to get out from under the backlogs. More now from the GAO's Director of Strategic Issues, Jay McTighe. Mr. McTighe, good to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And give us a sense of FOIA activity. Has it been on the rise? And tell us more about the level of backlogs some agencies, anyhow, are seeing.
Sure. We looked back over the last decade, looking at data from 2013 up through 2022, and we found that backlogs government-wide have nearly doubled to a little bit over 200,000 at the end of fiscal year 2022. You know, this reflects a long-term trend, a persistent challenge for federal agencies.
And simply, the public wants this information.
Absolutely. As you know, as you said, you know, FOIA is our nation's most important government transparency law. It gives the American public the statutory right to request government records. You know, all Americans have the right to know what their government is doing. So, you know, FOIA is central to government transparency.
And where do the backlogs tend to accumulate? These are not across the board evenly at all agencies, is it?
No, that's exactly right. So the Department of Homeland Security by far received the largest number of FOIA requests, accounting for about 60% of the government-wide total in fiscal year 2022. The Department of Homeland Security, together with the Departments of Justice, Defense, State, and Health and Human Services, together accounted for about 80% of all new requests. And as you said, the backlogs vary across the government, depending upon the agency. But overall, it's a big and growing problem.
And by backlog, that means those cases that have not been answered after 20 days, I think, is the statutory requirement.
That's right. FOIA generally requires agencies to respond to a request within 20 working days. And in their response, agencies should include a determination of the scope of the documents that they will provide and any exemptions that they claim, due to national security, personnel issues, or other information that they cannot provide to the public. Sometimes if there are unusual circumstances, an agency can extend that 20-day time frame for up to 10 working days, and the agency must also offer a requester the opportunity to limit the scope of the request or otherwise modify the request, again, to try to be responsive to the request.
And there's a few outlier cases sometimes that lay around for, I think the longest I ever heard of was 10 or 15 years. Sometimes they end up at the bottom of a pile.
Yeah, there are certainly cases like that. Most are not that bad. You know, we didn't look in great deal at specific requests during this audit. We were focused mainly on what agencies and what the Department of Justice is doing first to identify what the problems are with backlogs, you know, what are the root causes, and then what are agencies and DOJ doing to try to address the growing backlog? You know, it's clearly a problem.
We're speaking with Jay McTighe. He is the Director of Strategic Issues at the Government Accountability Office. And before we get to the root causes, tell us what Justice, that particular unit of Justice, what its job is in the whole FOIA area.
Yes, the Department of Justice oversees compliance with FOIA. Its Office of Information Policy helps agencies administer FOIA by providing guidance, training, and other resources to agencies. DOJ also oversees agencies' annual FOIA reporting requirements, which include plans for reducing backlogs, as well as information about, you know, the size of the backlog and how long it takes to process requests. And then finally, I should mention that OIP also manages the FOIA.gov website, which makes agencies' data available, their reports, and also provides information to the public about the FOIA process.
All right. And what did you find then with respect to their responsiveness to doing this and their knowledge of the actual causes? I think it might be staffing, it could be funding that they get for FOIA, it could be the complexity of the cases. I mean, there's a lot of variables.
There are a lot of variables, a lot of factors that go into this. And so what we did is, I mentioned the annual Chief FOIA Officer reports that are on the FOIA.gov website. We looked at the last 5 years of those reports and teased out what the key issues were. We also had focus groups with the 24 CFO Act agencies, you know, to get a little bit more granular detail about what's going on in the FOIA process. And so, yes, as you mentioned, staffing was one that came up quite often, as well as the increased scope and complexity of FOIA requests. And then, you know, other frequently cited issues included coordination across agencies, different offices and other units, you know, for some of the very broad requests. Litigation is something that has come up quite a bit lately. And then finally, technology. A lot of agencies are struggling acquiring technology to search records, but also technology has kind of made the retention and types of communication bigger and a little bit more challenging to deal with. You know, back in the day when FOIA was enacted into law, a lot of information was on paper. Nowadays, you know, you have all kinds of electronic communication. You have emails, you have instant messaging, you have text messaging, and so on and so forth. And that has generated just massive volumes of information that has to be searched. And it can take time, especially without the proper technology tools.
And you had a list of recommendations for the Justice Department and the Office of Information Policy. Highlight them for us.
As I mentioned, you know, backlogs have become a persistent and growing problem. The Department of Justice has taken steps to require certain agencies, those agencies with over 1,000 backlog requests, to develop, you know, actionable plans to reduce the backlogs. But what we found is that OIP could improve the guidance to agencies in regard to these plans, because currently in its guidance, it doesn't specify elements that should be included in these plans. And these are pretty basic elements, but really the cornerstone of effective plans, such as goals, performance measures, timeframes for implementing specific actions, and including that kind of information could really help make plans much more robust and actionable. You know, we did look at the 14 agencies that were directed by OIP to come up with plans, and only two of those agencies included specific goals, and only one included, you know, any kind of performance metric. And, you know, very few, actually none, included timelines for implementing the actions that they were going to take. So we had two recommendations to improve guidance on plans. And we also had two additional recommendations focused on the information that is reported to OIP on backlogs and the time it takes for agencies to respond to requesters. And there was some confusion in how agencies calculated some of that information. And, you know, without good data, it's hard to get a good handle on the issues. So OIP, the Department of Justice, agreed with all four of our recommendations and has already started drafting new guidance to include the information that we suggested and clarify both the information and training on providing some of the data in the FOIA reports that I mentioned.
So maybe we'll see some cleanup of those attics or basements, I don't know, depending on what you think of FOIA, wherever you stash them away. Jay McTighe is Director of Strategic Issues at the Government Accountability Office. Thanks so much.
Thanks again, Tom.
We'll post this interview along with a link to his report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, another take on that new cybersecurity rule from a contract attorney. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. That new safe software attestation rule from the Homeland Security Department has become final. Contractors have to start planning now for when the rule goes into effect this fall. Here with more on how to ensure compliance, Haynes Boone procurement attorney Dan Ramish. And Dan, let's start with your sense of whether software vendors are even aware of this or onto this whole thing.
Well, Tom, part of the challenge here is that the software that's covered is very broad. It's not just prime contractors that are selling software to the government, but it seems pretty clear that this will be required of software producers anywhere in the supply chain. And some of those companies may not even be aware that they're selling to the federal government. So it seems as though not all software producers that will need to comply with these requirements appreciate that they are upon them now with the attestation form now hitting the streets in final form.
And here's a question. What about firmware? I mean, if you buy a printer today, it's a full-blown computer with a hard drive and connectivity, and you can convert documents into texts and email them from a printer, all this kind of jazz. Would that be covered, I wonder?
Yes. Firmware, operating systems, applications, cloud-based software. It even covers, actually, products that contain software. So very broad in scope. The only limit is that there's a time cutoff, September 14, 2022, or more recent than that, if the software has been released or if a major version has been released, the software will be covered. And then there are some exceptions for software developed by federal agencies or open source software or third-party open source and proprietary components that are incorporated. It's only software end products that need to be subject to the attestation requirements.
All right. And then so this goes into effect precisely when? I mean, the rules finalized, but I think there's a little bit of prep time.
Yeah. So technically, there are either 3 or 6 months after the OMB approval of the final common form from CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And the exact date, they didn't nail that down when they issued it, as is not uncommon. The form came out on March 11th, but it was dated March 8th. So exactly where you're measuring from is not totally clear, but it'll be for critical software producers sometime in June, in early June, and then September for all other software producers.
And will this take the form of a FAR clause or a clause in contracts that the government issues?
So that's a good question. There is a FAR rulemaking in process. It's FAR case 2023-02. And there was an update in a recent publication noting that the CAC chair sent the draft proposed FAR rule to OIRA. So the rule is going to come in short order, I think. It probably will be a proposed rule, but that will formally implement this in contracts to contractors. And there will very likely be a flow-down requirement.
And a big question, I think, on a lot of contractors' minds is, will this have the implications of False Claims Act violations? If your attestation is there, but there's something wrong with your software, or your software is fine, but you didn't attest properly.
Yes, it's going to be very important to accurately and truthfully attest to the requirements. So it actually mentions right on the form that providing false or misleading information may be a violation of the Criminal False Statements Act if that is knowing and willful. There's also a DOJ civil cyber fraud initiative that's been going on since 2021 that's specifically trying to crack down on government contractors failing to meet cybersecurity requirements, bringing False Claims Act investigations and enforcement actions.
We're speaking with Dan Ramish, a procurement attorney with Haynes Boone. And notwithstanding false claims, there might be other penalties in here, which we'll get to. But has anyone thought about the question of, if you attest to the safety of your software and can prove that, to your best knowledge, the attestation was accurate, and somebody hacks the software anyway, what happens?
Well, so there is a knowledge component to a False Claims Act action. So there's also the possibility of liability for deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard of the truthfulness of the information. But if you're complying in good faith, you know, the Shoot case last year made clear that there's a subjective intent component here. If you're doing your best and if you're able to document that you intended to comply with the requirements, then there at least won't be an issue with fraud if, in fact, there is a breach, notwithstanding your efforts to comply.
All right. And tell us about something else you pointed out, the Justice Department's Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative that's been going on for several years now. It's kind of behind all this that could come and bite you.
Yes. So DOJ has been paying close attention. And of course, CMMC has been getting a lot of attention in this regard. And whenever there's a self-attestation requirement, there's heightened risk for the contractor because they're doing the assessment themselves that they're complying. So DOJ is particularly concerned, of course, because of the national security implications for the government if software isn't secure or if other cybersecurity requirements aren't met. That's the ultimate driver here. There was an executive order issued back in 2021 improving the nation's cybersecurity. And the federal government's concern is they need to be able to keep their own system secure. And to do that, the software that's being provided that they're using needs to be free from vulnerabilities. And there are concerns about knowing where all of the different code comes from. And so the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative is certainly one tool that is likely to come into play to ensure that contractors are attesting accurately to meeting the security requirements.
And I guess that could be rough play if things go wrong for you. And you also note that in the rule, there are alternatives to attestation for some companies. What are those?
That's right. So if a software producer is going to comply but can't yet comply with the attestation requirements. Maybe they're not meeting all of the required security practices. They can draft a plan of action and milestones, which is a basically a corrective action type document that identifies the practices they can't attest to and documents the measures they have in place to mitigate the risks. And then they submit that to the agency or agencies that are using their software. And if the agency's satisfied with the POAM, then they can continue to use the software, but they have to request either an extension of the deadline from OMB or a waiver in order to be able to do that. And OMB is going to be monitoring agencies' use of POAMs and acceptance of POAMs beginning in June of this year. They're going to collect data and make sure that software producers aren't kind of abusing this and agencies aren't abusing the POAM mechanism and are making progress at least toward meeting all the requirements.
And it looks as if CISA did loosen the final rule a little bit versus how they proposed it, probably based on industry comments. But you found that it looks a little easier than it might have when first proposed.
Yes, they did clarify the scope of attestation a little bit to be a little bit more fair to contractors. So the contractors are only attesting to the things that are actually within their control. And so one notable area on that is third-party components. And the final form adds language that says that software producers are only required to attest that they follow the secure software development practices for the code that they developed. And there's a specific carve out. So they're not attesting to third party producers of components following the practices. Now, they do have to follow their own precautions for incorporating third party components to mitigate the risk, maintaining trusted source code supply chains, using automated tools or other practices, and then maintaining provenance for internal code and third-party components to the greatest extent feasible. So they have to do some of their own homework to make sure that they are doing their best to avoid introducing vulnerabilities through third-party components, but they don't have to attest to those third parties following the same practices that they're required to attest to. And there's also a change in who is required to attest, which is helpful to contractors. The previous version of the form said that only the chief executive officer or the chief operating officer of the company was required to attest. And now there's an option for a designee of the company who's an employee and authorized to bind the company to sign the attestation instead of the CEO.
Yeah, can you imagine Satya Nadella of Microsoft, you know, being asked 30 times a day, hey, we've got another attestation for you, or Larry Ellison of Oracle. I don't think they're going to be spending too much time personally attesting.
Right. Well, and there were real concerns there, right? If your CEO is going to have to sign the attestation, even just doing the work to get them up to speed to understand the technical requirements, and then the level of documentation you would want to support that would be much more extensive. If you have someone who's technically savvy on your team, that gives you a greater level of comfort that they understand what they're attesting to.
All right. Dan Ramish is a procurement attorney with Haynes Boone. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. And this program note, get in on the latest trends in cloud computing. Join Federal News Network's DoD Cloud Exchange. The second day starts today at 1 on federalnewsnetwork.com. Hear from DISA's tech guy Corey Seville, the Army's Rob Shady, and other government and industry cloud computing thought leaders. Sign up now at federalnewsnetwork.com. 57 past the hour. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. Up next, the top national headlines from CBS News and the Federal Newscast. I'm Tom Temin.
The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, what to do about those ever-rising FOIA request backlogs. Plus, why selling software to the government is like visiting a confessional booth. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, now out of a hiring freeze, the Social Security Administration is preparing to rebuild its workforce, and fast. For years, the agency has faced low staffing, even while signing up millions of new beneficiaries every year. Recently confirmed Commissioner Martin O'Malley has some recruitment ideas in mind to make it happen. He says it'll take a bigger budget in fiscal 2025. Here with the latest, Federal News Network's Drew Friedman. And so it sounds like O'Malley feels staffing is one of the top problems?
That's definitely right, Tom. O'Malley says that SSA staffing is currently at its lowest levels in 27 years. And as you mentioned, this is at the same time that they're serving more customers and have more beneficiaries of Social Security than they have in their entire history of the agency. As a result, O'Malley has said that customer service is worsening. There's longer wait times on phone lines because there's not enough employees to answer them. There's delays in receiving decisions on disability applications and appeals for those decisions. So it's almost like a perfect storm of challenges. And O'Malley said as well that that's largely due to continuing resolutions and hiring freezes over the years that have prevented the administration from being able to staff up as much as it possibly can. Of course, that also causes problems for employees who feel overworked. They have too much work to do and not enough people to do it. This is particularly true in teleservice centers where employees are answering phones.
Sure.
And O'Malley actually warned lawmakers on the House Ways and Means Committee just last week of this exact issue.
Not surprisingly, when somebody's been on hold for an hour, they come off that call hot. And we right now have an attrition rate of about 24% in our teleservice centers. They are short-staffed, they are understaffed, and they are overwhelmed. Man, they're my heroes, and we need to do better by them. They are overwhelmed, stressed out, but still, every day, they're trying to make it work.
Sounds like a tough problem. And what does the Social Security Administration's budget look like now? And what is the White House requesting for 2025?
For this fiscal year, for the rest of 2024, the spending agreement that Congress just reached gives SSA a budget of $14.2 billion for its administrative expenses. That is pretty much on par with what they had for 2023, just about $100 million more. O'Malley told lawmakers, you know, it is better than a cut, and cuts were something that was on the table. But now he's looking for a bigger budget for SSA to try to really staff up and address some of those longstanding staffing challenges. For 2025, the White House is requesting $15.4 billion for SSA's budget. So breaking that down a little bit, there's $269 million for field office staffing, $85 million for processing centers, $79 million for teleservice centers, and then a really big budget for DDS, or the Disability Determination Services, $2.8 billion. It's a lot of numbers, but essentially it's about a 9% overall increase between 2024 enacted versus what the administration is looking for in 2025.
And did O'Malley give specific numbers on who he'd like to hire and in which positions?
He didn't give specific hiring goals in terms of numbers, but he's looking for more staffing for a lot, basically all of the components of SSA. So whether that's more judges, more field office workers, more people to answer the phones. I think all of those areas are places where they're going to be looking for more staff.
We need to change our strategy as an agency. I think we target too much on college graduates and not enough on high school and community college graduates. And with proper training, that could really be an investment that holds for a long time. You know, we used to have a program at SSA called Stay in School Kids. And I met people in Kansas City and town halls, employee town halls across the country. They've now been with the agency 40 years, but they're like, I was a stay-in-school kid when they hired me 40 years ago out of high school. So we could hire them if there's the money for it.
Yeah, some smart thinking there, it sounds like. And what about the concerns of lawmakers? What's their reluctance here?
On the House Ways and Means Committee, you had some concerns about just the caseload from members of the committee and looking for ways to improve customer service in a more short-term fashion. But I think one issue that kept coming up was also IT modernization. And a lot of lawmakers, or at least a couple, said that that was another way to ultimately improve workforce performance and morale. Currently, O'Malley said that 90% of SSA's IT budget goes toward just maintaining their outdated systems or their legacy systems and not actually towards modernizing SSA's IT. So the budget request is looking for some money to build on that and to try to start modernizing it. And Representative Blake, a Republican from Utah, described what he saw as the benefit of IT modernization.
We improve people's work experience by investing in these technologies to make their job satisfaction go up. You get better productivity out of them, and we'll see better hiring come from this type of stuff. So I encourage you to push as much as possible on this.
Well, it sounds like they're going to push on it. The sad thing is that Social Security has very clear statistics on how many people are going to enroll. They know all of the vital statistics of the country, life expectancies. They have squadrons of actuaries who calculate these things. They know exactly what their workload is going to be, how many checks, so to speak, how many benefits transfers they'll have to make per week, how many people they'll go to, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like they just need a process of convincing people, here's what it takes to do each 10 million recipients that we have. We're going to be adding 15 million in the next 2 years. Therefore, we'll need this capacity minus 5% for modernization or something. But that doesn't seem to have gelled as a process there.
Right. No, there are a lot of challenges. And I think you bring up a good point, Tom. There is, you know, ways that Social Security is trying to reform or thinking about reform. And they're proposing some ways specifically to try to staff up or adjust the way that their workflow works. But I think what you're hearing from O'Malley and other officials at SSA is that it's going to need that budget to back it up. But they're looking to hire up in all these different components. They're trying to focus in specific areas like hiring veterans, using skills-based hiring, as O'Malley mentioned, hiring more interns in 2025. So there's a lot of different paths that they're trying to put out, or feelers they're trying to put out, to staff up and really address some of those really long-term issues there.
Yeah, and they've got the statistics to make their case because they know exactly what their workload is going to be. And every 10 million recipients, we get this many phone calls. So maybe a little AI applied there. They'll have a better case to make to Congress. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, why selling to the government, software anyway, is like visiting a confessional booth. This is The Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.